Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm glad you could join us once more. I'm Joel Harrison, and joined by my co-host here, Dave Taylor. Last week, we discussed our name, the Eucatastrophe, taken from an essay by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it means the good catastrophe. And we kind of think this summarizes us as human beings, that is Dave and I, that we're works in catastrophic progress. So it raises for me, Dave, how are you a catastrophe?
I'm a 35-year-old man, and most of my underwear have Batman logos on it.
So do mine!
How did we know this about each other?
Why are we talking about that? That's, oh, I mean, I didn't mention that. I would never, no. Star Wars. Star Wars 2.
Yeah.
We should move on quickly. This episode, we want to continue our series aimed at giving you a sense of who we are and what we're... I can't just go crack up about that now. Who we are, what we are on about discussing, what we're going to discuss, ladies and gentlemen, is the topic of loneliness, or more broadly, I think, the lonely individual subject of our liberal society.
Now, this isn't just because we're lonely people, generally, although we're less lonely now that we know that we share the same underwear. But rather, we think, so it's not just that we're particularly lonely people that we think this is an important topic, but because I think it can demonstrate some of the key assumptions that we bring to bear when we're thinking about kind of political, ethical, or theological issues. It really touches on some of the central themes that we've been discussing and kind of trying to build on over the last few episodes. Now, loneliness is something that I think seems to occupy a lot of people's thoughts. It's something I've done a bit of writing on and discussing it with people. People actually ask me what I'm writing on and I'll say loneliness. Usually they just ask out of politeness. But I find that people were actually genuinely interested when I said I was spending a considerable amount of time thinking about loneliness as a concept. And so it seems to really touch on something that is going on for people. It's also something that's been acknowledged to be on the rise across the world, though not universally. There's places that are more lonely than others. And in Australia, one in six Australians apparently report experiencing prolonged periods of intense emotional loneliness. Furthermore, various medical studies are now examining the physiological consequences of chronic social isolation. This includes kind of things like increased risk of diabetes, heart disease, early death generally, as well as mental health issues like depression being a big one. There's also been studies into the cognitive effects of loneliness on the mind, with what some researchers from the University of Chicago talking about how loneliness puts us in a state of hypervigilance for social threat, which means that we're constantly on the lookout for any slight to our identities, making us incredibly kind of aggressive from those that would disregard our opinions or things like that, which I think explains basically the entire internet. So, which actually means that it actually affects the way that we act together as a political body. So if we're constantly on the lookout for being slighted, we're not forming a body politic very healthily. Loneliness has also become a political concern, and with ministerial portfolios being created to combat loneliness in the UK. Indeed, when I was travelling around the UK about 5 years ago, there was a huge discussion going on every radio station about loneliness, particularly loneliness in the elderly, with helplines being set up to help combat this problem, and a ministerial position being set up to address the issue as well. And here in Australia, in the state of Victoria, I don't know if they're already in the position already exists yet, but there's certainly been discussion of installing a Minister for Loneliness in Victoria, and then the possibility of one coming nationally. It's something that a fellow podcaster has discussed, our good friend Byron Smith's podcast, The Good Dirt. Its first episode looked at the issue of loneliness as well, and so we would commend that to you. Now, to start the kind of the deeper conversation going, Joel, do you think that loneliness as a kind of political, social, and ethical state or issue relates to, how do you think it kind of relates to liberalism as we've talked about it? Is it just a matter, is kind of addressing the issue like through things like having a minister for loneliness or a social program set up to combat loneliness? Is that enough to address the issue within the kind of liberal paradigm? Can we just tweak the way that we organize ourselves to become less isolated? Or is there something actually structural about liberalism that kind of makes us primed for loneliness? What do you think, Joel?
Well, I think on the minister for loneliness and so on, it really depends on what they're up to, right? Mm. Like if they're a minister that is almost like the minister for neighborhood communities,
yeah,
and their purpose is to cultivate, encourage civic association and the mutual flourishing of different neighborhoods, right? Then that's a good thing. They should be involved in that. Their purpose as a minister for loneliness is to create common spaces. So it's deeply ironic in the United Kingdom that they create a minister for loneliness at the same time they go through austerity, cutting back on public libraries and public spaces and public services and so on, right? So there's just a kind of potential just signaling, right, to take the common phrase, almost like a virtue signal on the Tory government's part to say, look, we're interested in loneliness while cutting back on all the things that make us have these common bonds with one another.
Yeah.
But your point as well then about, is loneliness like a byproduct of liberalism and so on? Well, I mean, there you're just kind of tossing me a ball and saying, here, puppy, have a play, right? Yeah. Because it seems to me that loneliness is almost baked into liberalism. That the liberal subject with this understanding at root of ethical individualism is kind of like a lonely subject.
Yes.
And I think of this in a number of ways, but just to draw out two. One is our understanding of politics as facilitating and furthering the rights of individuals. And then secondly, we might think about how in liberal thought there's a deep emphasis, I think, on distrust and attempting to ward off what is characterized as a fundamental reality, that mainly the conflict of individuals that are necessarily in conflict with one another. So, you know, on the first, understanding the ends of politics as the rights of individuals. So a liberal view of the state sees the ends of politics as to be secular means negotiating, managing, settling rights of individuals. So Nicholas Walterstorff, who's a Christian philosopher, right, he still sees the ends of political authority in this way. The state exists to protect the rights of individuals. And for some, this is seen as a basis of state sovereignty, right? That the state alone determines and negotiates rights. Now, that doesn't necessarily give rise to a social purpose, a shared end or a shared purpose or a shared attempt to build a community based in, say, what Augustine would call a common love. Rather, the only shared or social thing here is like a mutual protection of each other's rights. So we talked in the first episode about Aquinas, and his conception of property. For him, you own property for the purpose of distribution to others, especially those in need. Your purpose in owning it is to protect it for that common good. But now we think of maybe a right to property as the capacity for ownership, and my willing, the only thing that alienates that property from me is my own will to do so, or the expropriation by the state through taxation. Or you may think of expression, right? People think of freedom of expression as just simply serving autonomy. Mm. Or religious liberty, when people talk about that, they think of it as fundamentally just simply facilitating personal autonomy. Whereas in a more social way, you may think of expression as oriented towards good ends that cultivate a community. Or you may think of religious liberty as fundamentally orientated towards building a particular kind of community. Now, those would be sort of social things, but we don't talk in those ways. In fact, some theorists will talk about that rights talk can be boiled down entirely to the contest between people's personal autonomy claims. Mm. So in that way, we only encounter each other in this thinking either as mutual respecters of one another's individual rights, like a mutual respect of someone's privacy, or else we encounter each other in breaching each other's rights. So by infringing upon another person's property, privacy, expression, and so on. So our autonomies are conflicting, as it were. And so the only social thing there is that I mutually respect your autonomy, you mutually respect mine. There's not a shared or common object there, a project of solidarity, perhaps, of trying to find what it means to be a human together. Now, I think that has a certain loneliness to it, right? Mm. Because I'm cast upon myself, and also I encounter the other person, not in a common bond, but as a common, as a potential threat to me. Now, there's another point there I wanted to raise about, I can in a moment, unless you wanted to add to this. Mm. I wanted to add to that about that this also gives a certain loneliness, I think, to because if our job is just simply to pursue these individual conceptions of the good, it gives rise to what Charles Taylor calls a malaise of modernity.
Yes.
The potential thought that none of this matters.
Yep.
That you pursue your autonomy, I pursue mine, and so on, and it's relatively equal.
Yep.
And because it's relatively equal,
mm.
it has no real meaning.
Yep.
It's like an adornment.
Yes.
To the person, and so you know, there's a sense in which the individual becomes fungible with another individual.
Yes.
We're no longer placed within a relationship to each other in which I matter to your pursuit, our mutual pursuit of some common good.
Yep.
Right? My talents contribute to a common community in which we're trying to forge something together.
Yep.
But in fact, I could drop out of the picture and somebody else is there in their equal dignity and pursuing their autonomy. But why does it matter?
Mm.
Why does that matter? Like, what is the uniqueness of the individual if we're all just simply pursuing our own conceptions?
Yeah. There's a lot of really interesting points there. I think overall, we return to a thing I think that will come up in a lot of our discussions, which is tied into the way that we currently do politics, which is to take a structural issue about the way in which we do life and even conceive of ourselves as a body politic and turn it into a mental health issue. So we'll address loneliness as something, some weakness that exists within a particular individual that needs to be treated, rather than thinking, oh, actually, loneliness is the natural response, the way in which we have constructed our society. Mm. And then even thinking in terms of the city itself as an urban space, that itself has a particular structure or reinforces a particular social structure that isolates people from one another. But we don't ask questions about things like, you know, you use the British example, but like the closing of the commons there, the literal shutting down of possibilities of cohabitation, shared space and things like that. And then we kind of, you call it virtue, so or I'd say like throwing a bone to the issue by saying, oh, you poor things, let us address this. This emotional problem.
There's an interesting point you're saying there about, we individualize what could be structural. Mm. So, and you could take this, especially because we're talking loneliness, you could take it into this therapeutic culture, right? So a good friend of ours, who I don't know if he wants his name, anyway, he gave the example of sitting in a university committee and before having to engage with the committee process, they turned and said, now let's all engage in a moment of mindfulness.
Yes.
Right? Now, the idea there is you're turning like what you have to, the sort of stuff we have to wade through in our work lives that can be structurally dysfunctional at times and turning it into a therapeutic moment where your job is just to simply turn inward, release those things as a form of anxiety so that they no longer matter when actually we've arranged this this common life in a manner that has precipitated this very anxiety we're trying to then be mindful about.
And in its most extreme state, people talk about pharmaceutical interventions to solve loneliness. So you can kind of take a pill to take care of those negative health outcomes that I talked about at the beginning. for loneliness. But you see this in all sorts of other areas, like the way in which things like PTSD and trauma are treated, soldiers are treated for PTSD and things like that, where people are now starting to talk about just giving a pill that will immunize people from the trauma. And I kind of go, yeah, I can understand wanting to address a significant mental health issue with people, returning service people. But at the same time, are we robbing people of the natural consequences of engaging in killing and the ethical questions that raises? So this is all to say, I find this issue of taking something so tied to the structures of our society and then subjectivizing it. And, you know, this is, I think, something that will come up and up as we talk about things. We can talk about, I won't give them away now. But there's a number of things where we put it back onto the individual to deal with symptoms instead of...
And I think it's kind of like a, you know, there's something of an anxiety that can arise from just the notion that it is your task to forge a path.
Yes.
You know, this romantic individual who faces the world. So Locke has this passage in the Second Treatise where he talks of the natural duty of children to obey their parents, but he also frames it as children electing their society. You know, Rousseau had the idea that, of course, your creative freedom and so on is then chained by forming an association and so on. But this idea that, say, a child elects their society or a person elects something, or it has almost an element of, like, you know, when you're in a supermarket and you're faced with 10,000 different kinds of jams.
Yes.
The paralysis and the weight of that that is actually upon you. You know, it's not necessarily how we actually go about making decisions. And if we are, if that truly is how we make decisions, then I think then that is quite conducive to creating a certain anxiety.
You also touched on a bit before about the kind of how human beings under the kind of malaise of modernity become almost interchangeable because no one's pursuing any kind of real ends.
Well, we're not pursuing real ends together. So
yes.
I contrast with the personalist understanding, which I may elaborate on another time, but basically under that understanding, there is unique talent to the person.
Yeah.
The unique talent is that you have these gifts and skills and talents that can contribute to a body. Yeah. And so if you were to drop out of my life, Dave, you know, I don't want to think about that. You know, like Sarah would be a mess.
Yeah.
But I
have so many of your books. And
But yeah, I mean, like, exactly. You may take my books with you. Anyway, so, but, you know, your talents and your gifts matter to the interrelationship between us and others and so on and building this communal body.
Yes.
And mine do also, and we forge that together. So there's both our talents contribute to a common good. Whereas in the liberal understanding, my dignity arises from my abstract capacity to pursue a conception of the good.
And so I think that's a fascinating picture of that the point of pursuing our talents and our goods is to only make sense in a communal context, contributing to some sort of common project. Of some sense. And it really makes me think of, I think of that I'd like to talk about a little bit as we head towards the end, Hannah Arendt, who's someone that I love and respect very much. And this fits in with her understanding of what it means to be a human agent, or at least the way in which we make sense of ourselves as human agents, as people that can only make sense in community. We construct identity in her view, through kind of contributing materially to the environment that we find ourselves in. Now, Hannah Arendt, for those that don't know, is a 20th century German Jewish political theorist, sometimes called a philosopher, though she rejected that that title, I suspect, because of how angry she was at Heidegger for being a Nazi. But she's one of my favorite writers of all times, and I think she's just brilliant. But she has this to say about loneliness. This is a quote from The Origins of Totalitarianism, one of her most respected books. She says, and this is right at the end of her entire history of of how totalitarianism came to be in the 20th century. And she says this at the end of the book: what prepares men for totalitarian domination in the non-totalitarian world is the fact that loneliness, once a borderline experience usually suffered in certain marginal social conditions, like old age, has become an everyday experience of the ever-growing masses of our century. So what does Arendt mean when she says that loneliness is a preparation for totalitarianism? She says that loneliness was one of the kind of necessary preconditions for the rise of the totalitarian state in Nazi Germany. Well, for Arendt, we don't simply come to understand the world through individual reflection, like someone like Descartes might think. We start with a single doubt, and then because we are having that doubt, we can be sure of one simple thing, and from that one simple thing, we can build a belief in the entire world. Instead, Arendt sees us as coming to trust in the reality of the world through what she calls common sense. That is, through the confidence that what we experience as reality, the reality of our sensory experience, is shared. It's a common experience that we share with others. And Joel, Liam and I, all looking at the same table, we get a sense that we are all experiencing the same phenomena. And that's what builds epistemological certainty for us. This shared experience, kind of writ large, expressed as a culture, is actually made physical for Arendt in our places that we inhabit, such as cities. And these things come to carry our collective memory together, which makes sense of our place in the world, our shared assumptions and things like that. And in the totalitarian state and in the condition of loneliness, we get cut off from this common sense, this shared experience of the world, and we become isolated from one another, and we lose an ability to kind of contribute to that shared common project. What she would call that action is the word that she uses. And she says that we fall into a state where we lose the capacity to distinguish between kind of our even basic categories of truth and lies, or law and lawlessness, or right and wrong. All these things become indistinguishable because we lack our common sense. And that makes us, in Arendt's thinking, incredibly vulnerable to the power of ideology, which for her is a kind of machine-like thinking that's determined by a single premise, that it's lowered down from on high. So for her, it was always something about the driving force of history. What was the nature of history? So in the Soviet Union, it was the emancipation and the ascent of the dictatorship of the proletariat. In Nazi Germany, it was the rise of the Aryan race. So once you had that single idea, everything was able to be explained. And the people cut off from common sense have to rely on the ideology as a substitute for that common sense. Anyway, I could go on and on about this. I think it's a fascinating and very, very compelling argument. I think it has a lot of explanatory power about contemporary politics, particularly the way in which populism and things like that gets co-opted in, especially amongst particularly lonely people, and things like that. But there's all sorts of very interesting things that we can talk about here.
John, can I take it? I'm not sure I will get to totalitarianism, but I think this idea you're saying about the common sense and it being mapped on geographically and it being mapped onto these common spaces and so on, and almost like a building, almost like the communal epistemology.
Yes.
If I can take it in the direction of saying, it's interesting to think how that echoes something like a liturgy.
Yes.
Liturgy as the work of the people, the movement of the people, right? Mm. That then provides both that it's a movement towards something, but it's also the grammar of a tradition, right? So, and that we are fundamentally traditionalized in the sense that a tradition gives us the grammar for argument. It's not that we're necessarily always beholden in every respect, because a tradition may innovate or change somewhat, or how it changes, but that it actually provides us the the very language to conceptualize things together in order to hold a conversation, yes. right? Now that then makes me think about, well, that's fascinating to think in those terms, because if you break that open, if you shift away from, and thinking in a church context, from liturgy and that shared work of the people towards understanding it as a kind of unmediated personal relationship,
yeah,
or a pursuit of one's individual relationship in a kind of authentic manner, then you engage in a kind of memory loss or a kind of tradition loss or a kind of loss of grammar that then opens you up to, well, I don't know, what does it open up to you? It opens you up to schism, really, or actually probably schism, but also the incapacity to engage in political ethical reflection.
Yes.
Right, which makes me think about something like, you know, when we had this marriage postal survey and you heard all the terrible forms of debate we're having, it's because there isn't a capacity there to within these church bodies to actually necessarily reflect on what does it mean to live a common life.
Yes.
Right, because we've substituted that common sense you're talking about.
And Arendt would say, Arendt would have a very good description, a good explanation of the way in which that postal survey debate came about is because she says that once you actually lose a common kind of cultural touch points, you can only fall back onto proceduralism, which is exactly what a postal vote of all things on this issue actually is. It's a form of proceduralism in lieu of a substantive thick conversation about what the objective goods of
and we have to engage in that sort of proceduralism, because we're just throwing in the names now, dropping them like bombs, you know, like McIntyre talks about that we're dealing in a context where we argue through the fragments of moral traditions, right? So you no longer have, you're describing the common sense, I was describing like the work of the people, a sense of tradition, but actually people argue by dealing now in fragments of different moral traditions. And so there's a sense that, or that people, or maybe it's actually a matter of faith within liberalism, that there is no common sense.
And I suppose the thing I'd like to return to, going from the political back to the individual, I think what this loss of common sense through liturgy and the communal life of the church to the and the ascendancy of the individual in things like evangelicalism and reform theology. I gave a talk on this recently about my own experience kind of coming to faith in a reformed context. This emphasis on the individual, and particularly the individual's, the demand that the individual comes to have existential certainty about this robust intellectual system. The fact of the matter is that I don't know about other people, but I'm too small as an individual to generate that kind of certainty myself. And when I'm thrown back on myself to generate that authentic faith that I am told that I need to have in order to be a genuine Christian, I set myself up for existential crisis, which I constantly had for the early years of my life. And then coming to realize that, no, I come to faith through community and in a communal setting, and through participation in community, I enact faith.
Not just participation in a community in the sense of like you gather with some people.
No.
Actually the movement of these people together through something, towards something.
Yeah. And so learning about things like, what does it mean that our churches used to be in graveyards surrounded by the faithful departed to remind us that we are part of an ongoing historical conversation.
All of our churches used to be orientated to the east.
That's right. And everything that happens in a church had a meaning and a sense to it that drew the attention onto the common sense.
It's like I think of it like when we have like a reading in church. It's not necessarily because I'm going to then download the propositional content from a minister taking me through a morass of a 45-minute pseudo-lecture, right?
Yep.
It's that what I'm actually thinking is that I'm wanting to, you know, I think it should be when narrating these people into that story.
That's
right. There's the continuation of these people through this
testify.
Story.
Yeah, and absolutely. And if there's one thing I could say people should
just one thing.
If there's one thing that I could tell people to stop doing is
it's about your Batman. When you're coming
Oh my goodness, this is such a serious point.
Serious point.
If you are calling people to hear God's word written in read out in community, don't demand that people pick up their individual Bibles to read along. That's just something that never made sense to me. I could do that at home. This is a moment for us to stand and receive the words of Scripture and not be closed off in our own individual experience of a text. Anyway, I think that's incredibly significant. And I refuse to pick up that red pew Bible. I refuse.
You're like the rebellious man. You're like the lonely man who becomes a rebel. Yeah.
And forms community.
Yeah.
Which is why Leia is the best person in the Star Wars.
But your community can be a bit weird because you're Batman, remember? We said this back in week one. You're Batman. So your community is the foster child you take on to mold into your image. Then he grows up embittered by you. I shouldn't go on. Broken dreams, David. Broken dreams.
And spines. You've been listening to The Catastrophe. Thank you for joining us. I hope that you will subscribe and like our episodes on whatever platform for listening to podcasts you listen to. Please share us.
Leave a review.
All that engagement really helps us out. Please tell your friends and share our stuff around. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. You can find us at facebook.com/ Eucatastrophe Podcast. And you can follow us on Twitter at Eucat, that's EUCAT _podcast. And we will talk to you next week. See you later.